what's next after the aborted rebellion against Russia by the Wagner mercenary group?
President Putin is not the powerful kingmaker, puller of strings, puppet master that he had made out to be, that many people thought him to be. He has big problems.
Terror and fear is a daily emotion for Ukrainians living near the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
So scary. It's to the point where the people in the town almost can't even quite bear it. One woman told me that, yes, there are some government suggestions about what you do to protect yourself should there be a nuclear disaster, but she hasn't even read them because she's so close to the power plant. What exactly could she do? And she just doesn't want to become sadder.
Challenges for young Ukrainian refugees graduating from grade school and looking to get into college. Today is Tuesday, June 27th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. Russia experienced the most serious threat to the state in decades when the mercenary Wagner group mutinied and its leader threatened to storm Moscow and remove President Vladimir Putin from power. The episode was brief, lasting less than 24 hours, but it leaves big questions about the direction of Russia's operations in Ukraine and of Putin's political future. Our coverage begins with Jonathan Speer narrating this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
Wagner mercenary troops occupied the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don on Saturday for about 12 hours, encountering little resistance as they seized the local military headquarters. Now, after an agreement with the Kremlin, they will return to their bases in the territory that Russia occupies in Ukraine with promises of no retribution. The group's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, is going into exile in Belarus under the auspices of President Alexander Lukashenko, a Putin ally. The Wagner mutiny threatened the Russian capital and prompted harsh words from Putin against its perpetrators in an address to the nation. The Russian leader said what his government is facing now is treason and what he described as unreasonable ambitions and personal interests of the mutineers that led to treachery, treason and betrayal of the Russian people. Russian officials have flooded the media with assurances that Putin emerged stronger from this short crisis. But international observers say, on the contrary, the Russian leader's weaknesses have been irreversibly exposed. Keir Giles is a senior consulting fellow on the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House in London.
This destroys the myth that Putin had cultivated so hard of being completely in control and having a firm grip on power throughout the country. That is plainly no longer the case. And the Prigozhin incident sets an extremely dangerous precedent for power in Russia. Once other people see that this can be done and it can be survived, there will be other challenges.
Now, the Russian authorities are working to cover up the tracks of the Wagner Group, which until last week was praised by Kremlin propaganda. Prigozhin has challenged Moscow's narrative. Speaking of the precarious situation of the Russian army in Ukraine, one of the reasons why, Prigozhin says, he launched the mutiny. Prigozhin says the Russian side has had daily losses of up to 1,000 people. This, he says, include those killed, those missing, and those injured who are refusing to fight. Not because they are cowards, he says, but because they have no choice, no weapons, no supplies, and no command structure. Observers believe that whatever deal Putin has made with Prigozhin, a dark future awaits the mercenary leader. Keir Giles of Chatham House.
Whatever happens for the rest of his life, he'll be a man looking over his shoulder, because he will now be a marked man. He has challenged power in Russia and so far survived. The question is, for how long?
Calm has returned, at least for the moment, to the streets in Russia. But after the acute crisis last weekend, analysts say the events of the last few days may be a precursor to something bigger. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Jonathan Speer, VOA News.
Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko confirmed Tuesday that Yevgeny Prigozhin has arrived in Belarus after his short-lived armed rebellion in Russia. The head of the mercenary group Wagner was exiled to Belarus as part of the deal that ended the weekend mutiny. I spoke with former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, currently Vice President Europe and Russia at the U.S. Institute of Peace, for analysis on the current situation. What just happened here? What have we just witnessed?
Right. I think what we've just witnessed is the manifestation of a fractured military chain of command in Russia. What we've seen is the damage done to the Russian security services by Putin allowing both Wagner, but others as well, private military companies, to run unchecked. He got some benefit from the Wagner group earlier on because they were pretty good fighters. But then, since they were not really in the normal chain of command, they broke off. And as we saw, Prigozhin was not loyal to President Putin. This just demonstrates, in answer to your question, Laura, this just demonstrates the fragility of the Russian military chain of command. It demonstrates that President Putin is not the powerful kingmaker, puller of strings, puppet master that he had made out to be, that many people thought him to be. He has big problems. Putin has big problems at home in his immediate circle, and the second big blunder to allow the Wagner group to be out of control after his enormous blunder of invading Ukraine demonstrates to the Russian people, and in particular the people right around Putin, that he is not a very good decision maker.
Where does that leave Russia today? Is it weaker? Is he weaker than obviously has been exposed that he, like you said, is as he portrays himself to be? But does this weaken him further? Where does Russia stand?
Russia stands weakened after this. In particular, if perceived Russian strength came from the perception that Putin was in control, that Putin was competent, that Putin made good decisions, that Putin knew what he was doing when he invaded Ukraine, knew what he was doing when he gave a lot of authority and resources to Wagner and other private military companies. That's now damaged. That perception is damaged. He's no longer seen to be this great leader. And that affects Russia. That has to affect Russia. Russian citizens will be reconsidering their support for President Putin. They'll be reconsidering their support for this war that Prigozhin made a point of exposing the lack of a rationale. Prigozhin made the point, pointed out to both Putin and the Russian people and his own people and other Russian military that there was no reason to invade Ukraine, that there were no Nazis in Ukraine, that there were no Russians that were threatened by Ukrainian states, that there was no threat from NATO via Ukraine. All those rationales that Putin had put out there to try to justify his invasion, his decision to invade Ukraine, those are all demolished, or at least exposed to be fantasies. So, yeah, I think Russia is weaker today than it was before the weekend.
Putin is now trying to get Prigozhin forces to join the Russian military. And we're also hearing that Prigozhin is in Belarus with Lukashenko involved. He's loyal to Putin, so why would he protect Prigozhin? And what do you think that's all about?
You know, Laurie, that's a great question. There's a lot we don't know. There's a lot we don't know about this deal. You know, normally agreements are written down. It's pretty clear this is not a written agreement. So it must be verbal. This is not even a handshake. There's not even a face-to-face discussion on agreement. This must have been done over the phone or by email or something. It's not clear how this agreement was forged. So there's probably a lot of uncertainty on both sides about what was agreed. You're asked the right question about Prigozhin. Why would Prigozhin go to Belarus? Why would he trust Lukashenko, who, as you just said, is a puppet of Putin? Why would Prigozhin think that he would be safe in Belarus? Why would he think that his soldiers, the Wagner troops, would be safe or able to reorganize in Belarus? There's a lot we don't know. I imagine Prigozhin is taking precautions if he is in Belarus. He's taking precautions, and I imagine he's looking to see how he can get out of there as soon as possible.
Right, because I would imagine, given what we know of Putin, people who are not loyal to him or show any type of disloyalty end up falling out of a window or maybe getting poisoned.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. That's what happens to people who, and that's what happens to people who just say things or possibly present a political challenge. What Prigozhin did was present a military challenge. He revolted. He had a revolution. He had a civil war. He attempted a coup or some combination of those. And what does he get? The charges get dropped. He gets exiled to Belarus, and Belarus is essentially a part of the Russian Union state. So it's not at all clear what the agreement was. It's not at all clear that either side understands the agreement. It's not at all clear that either side will abide by the agreement. That's the other thing about Putin and probably Prigozhin, is there's no reason for them to abide by any agreement that they struck, in particular with Lukashenko.
Do you think that this could be the beginning of a change after all of these years with Putin and his role as the leader of Russia? Do you think that his position is now at its most threatened place in a long time?
Yes, I do, of course. Whenever you see a revolt, a rebellion by a powerful military unit within a state, you got to worry that, the dictator has to worry that he's not as in control as he thought he was. So yes, he's definitely weaker, as we've said, than he was. There are people around him who now have a little more doubts about his decision-making and his leadership. And when that starts to happen, when people start doubting that he is all-powerful, that Putin is all-powerful, then there are those who start thinking the way Prigozhin did. By the way, it's not just Prigozhin. I'm sure you reported a couple of weeks ago two other Russian military political organizations that had been organized in Ukraine by Russians, and those Russian units, those Russian organizations attacked into Russia, into Belgorod, into several towns around Belgorod, held territory for a while, entered into conflict, combat with the Russian forces. So it's not just Prigozhin. Prigozhin, these partisan forces of a couple of weeks ago, all of the Russians around Rostov, who were so supportive of Prigozhin, all of that makes it clear that President Putin does not have the full support of what he thought. And so, yes, this could well be the beginning of an unraveling.
Morale has everything to do with success, I would imagine. Ukrainian troops have high morale. Russian troops, I'm sure, are impacted even more. Their morale was already low, and I would only imagine this is also sort of making them question what they're doing.
It makes them question what they're doing. Again, Prigozhin made it clear that there was no rationale for this invasion, which means that there's no reason for those Russian soldiers to be in Ukraine. And the other side of the line, that is on the Ukrainian side, they were watching both with kind of amazement but also amusement, and their morale, as you just said, is very high. And it turns out the timing of this is fortuitous for the Ukrainians, because they've been preparing, as we all know, this counteroffensive that is already started, already underway in the first phase, which is just these probes up and down the Russian line. The Russian line, which is now weaker because it doesn't have Wagner, it's now weaker because its morale is low. It's now weaker because there's chaos in the Russian chain of command. So on the Russian side, they're weaker, and on the Ukrainian side, they're stronger, they're prepared, they're looking for the weaknesses, which are probably now greater than they were just before the weekend, and the Ukrainians have the advantage at this point.
So is your sense that this will impact Ukraine's success in its counteroffensive?
This will increase the odds of success for the Ukrainian counteroffensive. Yes, it increases the odds. You can't predict with any confidence, no one can predict with any confidence, the outcome of combat. It's unpredictable. You can do your best, and General Zelensky and General Sirsky and President Zelensky, they've all put their effort into increasing the odds of success. But you can't say it's assured. No one knows what happens once the battle gets underway in earnest. What we know is that the Ukrainians have prepared very well. They have 9 to 12 very capable new brigades that are well equipped and well trained and eager to go into the fight. They've not yet been committed, and that will increase the odds, again, with the problems on the Russian side and the high morale on the Ukraine side, increases the odds of a successful counteroffensive.
Thank you so much for your perspective. It's really appreciated.
Thank you, Laura. Good to be here.
William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, currently vice president of Europe and Russia at the U.S. Institute of Peace. A new report by the U.N. Human Rights Office examines the detention of civilians by both Ukrainian and Russian authorities over a 15-month period from the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year to May of 2023. The report documents hundreds of cases of arbitrary detention, summary executions of civilians, and torture, mostly by Russia, but Ukraine also does not have completely clean hands. UN monitors were given access to Ukrainian places of detention, but denied access to Russian detention facilities. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. As tensions soared inside Russia between the government and private military group Wagner, frontline Ukrainian fighters say their fight with Russia has not subsided. I spoke with VOA's Heather Murdoch, who's been traveling throughout Ukraine, to bear witness as to what has been happening. Where were you and what did you see?
We were at the Kovka Reservoir, which is near Zaporizhia, and for hours you can drive along the coasts of that reservoir. Local people call it their sea because it's so big that in many places you cannot see the other shore across it. It's been around since the 1950s, and it supplies water to millions of people. This reservoir, we were shocked. Like everyone I was with, it was a team of five, three Ukrainians, and all of them were just mouths hanging open. It is dry. It is a huge muddy plain with maybe some water in the middle. And this all happened in just a span of a couple weeks. We then traveled downstream for a couple of hours, and it's still dry. And we went to towns and villages, and many of them have no more water or almost no water in their pipes. And this is just in the weeks of the aftermath of the dam explosion. The true nature of this crisis is only just becoming discoverable. Farms are not able to water their crops. People don't have water. People are bringing in water even to wash their dishes and flush their toilets from other towns already. And it's just been a couple of weeks. So this was quite shocking. We also were in one town that is near this reservoir that has been dried up. And across the way is the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And the government of Ukraine has warned a couple of times in the past week that they are very concerned that Russia, who controls the power plant, is planning what they call some kind of terrorist attack using the plant.
There has been, as you said, a huge concern about a potential Russian attack on this nuclear plant that could have just astronomical repercussions from this. What were you seeing surrounding the area, and what were people saying?
The town of Nikopol, which is the closest to the plant across the reservoir, or what was a reservoir, is actually quite isolated already. You have to have special permission to go there. If you don't live there, you're not allowed in. And local city council members told us this was because there's also a lot of manufacturing, and it's so close to Russian forces that you can see the power plant from the town where Russian forces are stationed, that they're very concerned about saboteurs coming in into this incredibly valuable town with all of the manufacturing that goes on. Inside the town, almost everyone you see on the street is carrying water bottles and buckets because they have almost no running water because of the reservoir drying up. So this is like a daily effort by almost everybody in the town right now, and it's taking up a lot of time and creating a lot of hardship in a place that's already also getting shelled daily. And just on Monday when we were there, that day, two people were killed in town in a shelling. And this is not that unusual there. So people are having a really hard time, even beyond the nuclear issue. But that is so scary. It's to the point where the people in the town almost can't even quite bear it. One woman told me that, yes, there are some government suggestions about what you do to protect yourself should there be a nuclear disaster. But she hasn't even read them because she's so close to the power plant. What exactly could she do? And she just doesn't want to become sadder by reading this. We also went to the city hall and tried to talk to the mayor or city planners. And as we were told, that everyone was so busy planning evacuations and contingency plans of what to do if this nuclear power plant was somehow assaulted by the Russians who are controlling it, that they couldn't have any time to talk to us.
Why would anyone stay?
It's a really good question. A lot of people have left. A lot of people left at the beginning of the war. We asked a few people, and The answers were similar to what you hear in other places, but surprisingly enough, there was a more variety of people there. Often you hear from people who are staying in places that are so dangerous that they don't leave because they can't. Poverty is usually the main reason, and often infirmity. People who are elderly or sick often choose to stay. Sometimes people who are older say that that's the reason. I'm older and I've lived here my entire life. I'd rather die here than be homeless someplace else and begin a new life as a refugee in my 80s or something. But in Nikopol, we met young people who have lives in Nikopol and have jobs. And as I was saying before, there's industry there, which is not the case in a lot of the war zones in Ukraine. So I imagine some people are staying because of the jobs and because they're being shelled like so many other places. The only main difference is the nuclear power plant. And that is so terrifying that it's almost impossible to wrap your mind around when you see it.
VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from Ukraine. The Vatican said Tuesday Pope Francis's peace envoy is heading to Moscow Wednesday in hopes of helping find a solution to the tragic current situation of the war in Ukraine. Poland hosts about 500,000 school-aged Ukrainian refugee children. Many high school graduates outside their homeland are choosing to take Ukraine's final state exam, which is mandatory for applying to Ukrainian universities and sometimes accepted by European ones. After the war started, the test was held in Ukraine and locations abroad. Lija Bakalets has the story from Warsaw, Poland.
It's more than an hour until Ukraine's final state exam starts, but students have already gathered near a test center in Warsaw, Poland. 17-year-old Darina Grachno came to the test center with her mother and grandmother. They fled Bakhmut in the Donetsk region last year and have lived in Poland since then. I'm not nervous now, Grachno says. I decided to accept any result. This test center is among the many in Europe, Canada, and the US that the Ukrainian Minister of Education launched for Ukrainian graduates who fled the country after the Russian invasion. For everybody in Ukraine and abroad, the test starts simultaneously, regardless of the time zone. Oksana Kolesnik, director of Warsaw Ukrainian School, explains. The exam includes the Ukrainian language and mathematics. They are mandatory, she says. The third subject a student can choose. A student has 180 minutes to complete the entire test. Before the war, Ukrainian graduates had several separate final exams. But once the war started, they were replaced by one multimedia test. In war conditions, gathering children several times for separate tests was dangerous. This year, unfortunately, everyone understood that the war would continue during the final exams, and it was necessary to prepare for this, says Oksana Kolesnik. This test is mandatory for those who want to apply to Ukrainian universities. Some students still want to continue their studies in Ukraine despite the war. Also, some European universities accept the test results. Evgenia Dmitruk is from Nova Kakhovka in the Kherson region, which is occupied by the Russian army. While living in Poland for over a year, she attended a Ukrainian school. She says she began preparing for the test a year ago. I need this test for Polish universities, says Dmitruk. I want to get a higher education in Europe and then, after the war is over, to return home and work there. For Ukrainian children, stress from the war complicates the educational process. Svetlana Levkovska, a teacher of Warsaw Ukrainian school, explains. Some fled from occupied territories, some survived shelling and hostilities, she says. It was a tough period of adaptation. Now I can see they are a little bit settled, but that is until there is bad news from their home. More than half the school-age Ukrainian refugee children remain outside the Polish education system, according to Poland's Education and Science Ministry. Poland doesn't require Ukrainian children to enroll in local schools, so many study online at their Ukrainian schools or find offline ones with Ukrainian curriculum. Lesia Bakalets for VOA News, Warsaw.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage of Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.